and turn to Jeremiah chapter 2. That was a fun song to start with because he has a mean message this morning. I say he is in Jeremiah, and so I'm just going to get his message. If you didn't get a handout, lift your hand up. We'll make sure everyone gets our outline. And if you didn't let us know, I think we got everybody on the way in. Do we have everybody? Very good. All right, we're going to be in Jeremiah chapter 2. Now, Jeremiah, we said a couple weeks ago, starting through this book, Jeremiah is a long book. And for that reason, I have been everyone's been suspicious that I will never get out of Jeremiah. And that is not necessarily an unfounded suspicion. However, in the prophets, you have to recognize that you may have noticed this, and there's probably a couple reasons why, but in the prophets, they tend to take a little bit longer to say their message than an epistle. We spent a long time in Hebrews, but it's only 13 chapters, and a lot of them are just not that long. Jeremiah is extremely long. Part of the reason might be the New Testament assumes you know a lot, and so it refers to the Old Testament and dumps a massive amount of material in a single reference. But in the Old Testament, they didn't have that. They were making the references. And so they tend to take a little bit longer. Jeremiah, what we're going to do this morning is we're going to give Jeremiah's first message. He starts, and the prophets are easy this way. Most of the time when they begin a new unit, they begin a new unit of information, whether it's an illustration or it's their sermon, it will begin with an introduction, like, the word of the Lord came saying. And then it'll do that again throughout the book to remind you when he's starting something new. In Jeremiah chapter 2, he begins his first message. Remember in chapter 1, he is told that he is called to preach to the nation of Israel. I gave you a timeline once again in your handout to remind you about what's going on in Jeremiah's time. He is preaching in the last days of Judah. As they are coming to the end and Babylon is marching on their gates, or they will soon, Jeremiah is telling them it's because of the choices that they've made. And this morning, he gives his first message. So the first message actually extends into chapter 3. To be honest, I don't know why they broke up chapter 3 the way that they did. Chapters and verses are not inspired. They are just navigational tools that were put in there in like the 1500s during the time of the Reformation. So don't bank all your theology on how the chapters and verses get broken up. And one example is this morning. There's no indication his message is done at the end of chapter 2, but there is an indication he's done at the end of chapter 3, verse 5. And so that's where our message is going to go. And almost every commentator I read ends his first message at this point. So there we are. Jeremiah is going to give, in the next few chapters, between now and chapter 15, he's going to give a prophecy against Judah. Judah thinks they're fine. Judah thinks that they're okay. Judah doesn't think that they're doing anything wrong, or at least not that bad. These messages are going to try to convince these people that this is not true. His sermon is not difficult to understand. Of course, we're going to have to articulate maybe some of the ways that he phrased a couple things, and that's true, but the message itself is not complicated, but it is very pointed, and some of us in here our knee-jerk reaction is to react just like the way that Jeremiah was told the people would react to his message. If you're in chapter 2, remind ourselves about chapter 1, verse 19, one verse earlier. He says he's going to send them to preach to the people, and it says this, and they shall fight against thee. Because being told things that we need to fix is never comfortable. So our first reaction is to say that they're wrong or they're bad or they mean me ill, and so they will fight against them. And a lot of times that can be our reaction to some of these pointed messages as well. We fight against it. His first message has a very simple point and a very simple illustration, which is this, and we'll get into the message as we go. I don't have time to read it through multiple times, so we're going to read it as we go through the message. But it's a simple point that we can be, and we often are, spiritual adulterers. Now, this is an illustration, obviously. We're not technically married to the Lord, although he uses that relationship in order to get us to understand some things. Why does he use the term adultery? And we're going to see it. throughout the chapter, he borrows from the marriage relationship illustration through the whole chapter. Why does he do that? Because we have all kinds of relationships, don't we? When your boss gets mad at you because you didn't turn in the thing on time, or he tells you you need to be on time because you've been late to work more often, or you didn't meet the conditions of your contract or whatever. He rebukes you and you go on with your life and we go on. Nobody feels like betrayed or forsaken. It's just, it was uncomfortable and we go on. Your friend maybe isn't there for you and you feel a little bit forgotten. But when a marriage relationship and one of them is unfaithful to the other one, there is no parallel to that in any other relationship that you have. The intimacy and the openness of a marriage relationship means that when somebody betrays that, the hurt and the betrayal that goes along with that is infinitely more. So why does he use this illustration of adultery? Because he wants us to recognize that when we turn our back on the Lord, when we do the wrong thing, when he's faithful to us and we're unfaithful to him, it's a big deal. It's not just that you came in late to work. It's not just that you weren't able to help your friend move. It's that you are unfaithful to your spouse. That is a completely different category entirely. And so he doesn't use light terms. He uses weighty terms because he's talking to a lot of married people. And he says, I want you to put yourself in my shoes and think that if you were faithful and you were a provider and you were good and you were kind and you were a faithful spouse and then your spouse cheated on you, what does that do to your heart? This is what's happened with us. This is not the first time or the only time this terminology is used in the Bible. He uses it in the New Testament. Ye adulterers and adulteresses, know ye not that friendship with the world is enmity with God? He says, so the Christian, this is true for the Christian as well as the people in Israel. This is not a new concept or a difficult one to understand. And so I'm going to try to go consistently through this message because I can't afford to break up every sermon that I give you because it will be true. We will never get out of Jeremiah. So, but as I said when we opened, this is not a complicated message to understand. It's just a hard one to swallow. So number one, four sections to his sermon about the spiritual adultery of his people. Number one, he tells us to remember the honeymoon. Remember the honeymoon. Now, he doesn't actually say the word honeymoon, but he actually gets very close to it. He borrows from this marriage relationship terminology throughout his message, and he begins his message with it. At the beginning of his message, at the beginning of a relationship, you know how it starts, where there's excitement and there's butterflies and we wouldn't even think to be unfaithful to that person because we love them, right? That doesn't even pass our mind. It's just obviously I'm going to be their one and only, and this is how they were when they began. Letter A, we were faithful to God. We were faithful to God. So let's open our message. Look at verse number 1 of chapter 2. We're going to read down to verse number 3. Moreover, the word of the Lord came to me saying. Now, by the way, everyone assumes that this is really his first message, in the timeline as well. So this would be preached, if that is true, in the 13th year of Josiah on your timeline, it would be right at the beginning of Jeremiah's ministry. So this really is the beginning. Verse number 1. The word of the Lord came to me saying, go and cry in the ears of Jerusalem, saying, thus saith the Lord, I remember thee, the kindness of thy youth, the love of thine espousals, talking about when they were first became one, they first were married, when thou wentest after me in the wilderness, in a land that was not sown. Israel was holiness unto the Lord, and the first fruits of his increase. All that devour him shall offend, and evil shall come upon them, saith the Lord. The love of thine espousals. When the relationship was first begun, we loved him. He says this, we went, look at verse 2, we went after him in the wilderness in a land that was not sown. When Israel first followed the Lord out of Egypt, where did he follow him to? They followed him to a desert. They didn't follow him right into the promised land. They followed him to a desert. Why does he bring that out? He says, when we first began our relationship, you followed me wherever I led. And the first place we went was the desert. And you followed me there. Now, they had problems, that's for sure. But that's what he says, into a land that was not sown. You know, when we first started a relationship, right, with our spouse, we would do anything for them. We'd go anywhere with them. Whatever they wanted us to do, I will do it for you. And then later on down the road, they'll say, you want me to do what? I'm watching the game. There's a difference, right? Well, you followed me wherever I would go. Not anymore. He says this, Israel was holiness unto the Lord. The word holy doesn't just mean to do what is right, as opposed to doing what is wrong. Especially in the Old Testament, the word holy means to be set apart for a special purpose. For example, in the tabernacle, there was holy objects. They weren't righteous objects as opposed to evil objects. They weren't, you know, doing the right thing as opposed to doing the wrong thing. The table wasn't getting up in the morning every day and making good decisions, okay? It wasn't holy in that way. It was set apart to the Lord. And so it was holy. It was a holy table. It was a holy candlestick because it was set apart to him alone. What's it saying with Israel? You were holy unto me. You were set apart to me only. Just like we say, when we are married, make our vows, I am yours only and no one else's, forsaking all others, we say. This is how the relationship began. And it was true for them. He says, we were faithful to the Lord. Early in most relationships, people don't even want to be seen talking to somebody else, hardly for a lengthy period of time, lest anyone think that they're interested in anyone but the one that they love. If anyone talked bad or messed with the person that they love, they would be there for them. They would stand up for them, and their other spouse would stand up for you. This is what he says there at the end of that verse, verse number 3. All that devour him shall offend, and evil shall come upon them, saith the Lord. He says, there's other people that are going to come against you, and they are going to get messed up because you're my people. And God says, so I'm going to take care of you. So if anybody messes with you, or watch, anybody curses you, then they will be cursed because we're faithful. But what happens? Letter B. God has given his people no reason to stop being faithful. God has given his people no reason to stop being faithful. Now, in this section, I try to outline, I think in outlines, so some of these themes are going to show back up again. It's a little bit cyclical throughout this chapter, which is okay. But in this passage, he's going to start introducing the fact that they are no longer faithful. But he begins it in terms of, but have I been unfaithful to you? To give you any reason to think that you shouldn't be faithful to me? So look at verse number 4. Hear ye the word of the Lord, O house of Jacob, all the families of the house of Israel. Thus saith the Lord, what iniquity have your fathers found in me, that they are gone far from me, and have walked after vanity, and they are become vain? God asks a simple question. You have walked away from me, but what is it that I did? Point out something that I have done wrong. Point out something that I have been unfaithful in. At this point in time, in Jeremiah's day, they had lived in the land. They weren't in the desert. They weren't in the land that wasn't sown. Since the time that they began their relationship, they were brought into a land and given vineyards they didn't plant and given cities they didn't build. Since that time, God has blessed them exceedingly. And he says, so what did I do? What did I do in the past? All the stories your fathers have passed you. Which one of those have I been unfaithful to you? Look at verse 6. Neither said they, where is the Lord? Now, the idea of where is the Lord is not, why has he forsaken us? It's more of, where did he go? Did we notice that he's missing? This is a dumb illustration, but maybe it'll help. The idea, because he says this twice. He says it in verse 6 and he says it in verse 8. Where is the Lord? Nobody's asking that question. So you come to church, right? And you know some people. There's some people in the church building. There's some people in this room that you don't know. And so that's just the way that it is. So they could come on Sunday morning and you would notice that they are missing. Or they would not come on Sunday morning and you wouldn't notice that they are missing. So you come in on Sunday morning and somebody who normally sits near you in your circle, your radius that you end up talking to before Sunday school begins, they're not here. And so you ask one of your other friends, where are they this morning? Why? Because you notice that they're not there. Their presence matters to you. There's somebody else who didn't come last week and you were in your spot and they were sitting on the other side of the auditorium. You didn't ask any of the people in your circle, where are they this morning? Because you didn't know. That's fine. But the point is, what they're saying is, a lot of my people are not asking, where is the Lord? They're just going about their day, not missing him at all. So that's true. That's not on their lips. But he continues, Neither said they, verse 6, where is the Lord that, and reminds them of all the things that he's done for them. Shouldn't you notice my absence? Who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, led you through the wilderness, through a land of deserts and of pits, through a land of drought and of the shadow of death, through a land that no man passed through and where no man dwelt. There's no reason you should have made it out there alive. There's no reason you should have become a nation after going through the desert. But you did. Verse 7, and I brought you into a plentiful country to eat the fruit thereof and the goodness thereof. But when ye entered, ye defiled my land and made mine heritage an abomination. The priests said not, where is the Lord? And they that handle the law knew me not. The pastors, the idea is that it's not that they had pastors like they had churches, but those who shepherded the people. The word pastor means to shepherd. Also transgressed against me. The prophets prophesied by Baal and walked after things that do not profit. So he says, when you got your land and when you got our blessing, when our relationship continued, every area which I'm supposed to be involved, my law, my truth, my blessings, all of them you sought for somewhere else. And he says, none of you are asking, where am I? But I have given you no reason to come to that place. The friend who's been faithful to you your whole life, and then you just abandon him as if he hasn't had a relationship with you your whole life. Or the spouse who's been faithful to their spouse their whole life, and then they walk in their home and don't even notice whether or not they're home right now. He says, this is how you're living your life in your nation. You're living your life, and whether or not I'm there holds no bearing to your everyday decisions, holds no bearing to your emotions, holds no bearing to how you live. Is that true for us? Is it true for us that we can, it's possible for us to live our life every day, go Monday through Saturday? We only remember on Sunday because somebody forces us to when we open up God's word, but we can live our whole life, and whether or not God is a part of our life holds zero bearing on what our life is like. Do we ask, where is the Lord? But the question we have to ask ourselves is God given us any reason to live that way? Is eternal life not enough? Has he not kept his promises? Has he not been merciful or long-suffering enough for us? And we spend our lives complaining about God as if after all that he's done, somehow he owes us even more than that. He says, remember the honeymoon where we began and where you've come. Number two. So after that, number two, his people changed their lovers. So they loved the Lord. They were faithful to the Lord. What the Lord says we will do, they said in like Deuteronomy and Joshua, whatever, we will make that. And they followed him wherever he would go. But not so anymore. Look at verse 9. This is a sad commentary. Wherefore, I will yet plead with you, saith the Lord, and with your children's children will I plead. And listen to this. Pass over the isles of Chittim and see, and send unto Kedar, consider diligently, and see if there be such a thing. Verse 11, what thing? I'm going to other nations, foreign nations, heathen nations, I'm supposed to watch for something. What am I looking for? Verse 11, hath a nation changed their gods, which, by the way, are yet no gods? But my people have changed their glory for that which doth not profit. Be astonished, O ye heavens, at this, and be horribly afraid, be ye very desolate, saith the Lord. He says something very simple. Go to another nation and ask yourself, are they faithful to the God that they worship? And usually the answer is yes. You go down to Philistia, they will have a well-swept, well-attended temple to Dagon. You go over to Moab, and they will have a well-staffed and orderly system to worship the god Chemosh. And you're going to go to all these nations, and they will be faithful to their gods, which are no gods. But my people have changed their glory for that which doesn't profit. You actually have the true God, and you're the one switching to love something that has no value. The fact is, Christians often spend their life doing the same thing. Do you know what he accuses? Do you know how he identifies idolatry in the New Testament, the way that he phrases it? He says it's worshiping the creature more than the creator. So by building an idol, what we're doing is we're worshiping a bird, we're worshiping a beast, we're worshiping the stone in the woods, or gold, whatever. We're worshiping the creature more than the creator. So no, you might not have an idol, but we worship the world more than we worship God. It is identical, it just manifests itself differently. And the thing is, the people in the world are faithful to the things that are important to them. More faithful than we are to God most of the time. There are people who know more about Disney than we know about our Bibles. And that's really sad. There are people who are more faithful to their bowling league than we are to church. And that's sad. There are people who are more committed to cheering for their football team than we are to praising God. And that's really sad. And so go to the world, go down to the bar, go down to your neighborhood's house and look in their windows. They are faithful to their gods. And we aren't to ours. And we're the only ones who have a real God to worship. We've changed our lovers, and the people in the world haven't. That's sad. Number three, by changing lovers, this is my longest point because he starts to go into some of the things they've done as to why. Number three, by changing lovers, they have brought problems on themselves. For my people, verse 13, have committed two evils. What are the two evils? They've forsaken me, the fountain of living waters, and they've hewed them out cisterns. Broken cisterns that can hold no water. Our fellows are coming by. If you could have your attendance slip, we'd appreciate that. They're going to take those, just so we know who's here this morning. So he gives an illustration. We've forsook the Lord, and they have gone after the stuff of the world. Whatever that is in your time or my time, it's the stuff of the world. And he provides an illustration. They have forsaken the fountain of living waters. The reason why water is so important as an illustration is because you have to drink every day, and you have to get your water from somewhere, right? And so having a fountain that always gives water is a perfect resource. If you are thirsty and you have a fountain, you have a spring that comes to the surface, great. Now you always have water. When you're thirsty, you can quench your thirst. He says, but my people have forsaken the fountain of water. And what have they done? They've hewed them out cisterns. A cistern is just, you know, a water holder to hold water. But it's a broken one that can hold no water. So what are the two evils? We have forsaken the Lord, and number two, we have replaced it with that which cannot fill us. What a dumb decision to make. I have a perfectly fine spring, and I'm going to bury it, and then I'm going to build a cistern that never has water in it. But that's what we do. The Lord is everything we need. That's what he tells us in John chapter 4. He tells the woman who went to the well. He says, whoever drinks of the water that I will give him will never thirst. The water that I shall give him will be a well of water springing up into everlasting life. He says, I will be everything you need. And God was everything that they needed. He gave them their land. He gave them their prosperity. But it wasn't just about wealth. It was that their needs were taken care of and their relationship with God was whole. They had everything that they needed. But not only did they forsake what they needed, they held on to that which did not fill them. They were continually empty. You go back and you can go back and read it. And we went through the Kings a couple years ago. And you just watch the storyline. When the storyline is positive and good and encouraging, it's when they're following the Lord. And when everything's falling apart in the story is when they're not. And he says, so why would we forsake the fountain of water and then hew out cisterns that hold no water? We're bringing problems on ourselves. He goes on. Verse number 14, is Israel a servant? Is he a homeborn slave? Why is he spoiled? You're not intended to be subject to all of this. You're not a slave. Why are you being taken advantage of? Like verse 15, the young lions roared upon him, yelled. They made his land waste. Cities are burned without inhabitant. Also, the children of Naph and Tahpenes have broken the crown of thy head. You're not in a situation where this should be true. That's what he's saying. You are not vassal nation at the mercy of the nations around you. You weren't supposed to be. That's not your identity, and yet you're living like it. Same thing. Are we a slave? The Bible tells us in Romans chapter 6, we're not slaves. We have been freed from the bondage of sin, but whom you yield yourselves servants to obey, his servants you are to whom you obey. So we're not slaves, but we've been spoiled. So many Christians are not slaves. They are not bond servants to sin anymore, but they've been spoiled by sin because they've yielded themselves servants to it. They were not, sin was not their master, but they have made it their master anyway. It's the same question from they asked Israel can be asked of us. Are we slaves? No. Well, then why are you spoiled? Because of our decisions. Look at verse 17. Hast thou not procured this unto thyself, in that thou hast forsaken the Lord thy God when he led thee by the way? And now, what hast thou to do in the way of Egypt? To drink the waters of Sihor? Or what hast thou to do in the way of Assyria? To drink the waters of the river? Do you see the illustration he tied together? You have hewed yourself out cisterns that hold no water. So he says, we're not going to drink of the fountain of living water of the Lord. We're going to try to drink of the waters of Egypt, drink of the waters of Assyria. Maybe Egypt can fill us. Maybe Assyria can fill us. Maybe the world can be what we need. We have changed our source of life. What do? We try to quench our thirst with the waters of Egypt and Assyria. They'll help. They will fill me. They will give me life. They will give me strength. And this is often the response of the average Christian. We turn from God, and so he ceases to fill our hearts. And so we are empty. And so what do? We try to fill our lives with something else that doesn't fill us. So we go to Egypt or to Assyria. We go to our pleasures or our lifestyle or the promises of the world. Maybe they will give me what I need. We try to quench our thirst, and we are still dry. But he says this, whose fault is that? Go back to verse 17. Hast thou not procured this unto thyself? You have made this life for yourself. I gave you a good life. You have given yourself a bad one. Verse 19. Thine own wickedness shall correct thee, and thy backslidings shall reprove thee. Know therefore and see that it is an evil thing and bitter that thou hast forsaken the Lord thy God, and that thy fear is not, that, sorry, my fear is not in thee, saith the Lord God of hosts. So how is it that they did that? What he's going to do is he's going to label here in the next few verses, a few things that he can identify in their life. That is the wickedness to which he is speaking. Their own backslidings that he's speaking of. So I'll give them quickly. Letter A. By failing to be faithful to a faithful God. What is it that we are not being faithful in? Verse 20. For of old time I've broken thy yoke and burst thy bands. I've given you freedom. Remember you were slaves and now you aren't? I did that. And thou saidest, I will not transgress. You said, I will do the right thing. I will follow you. I will be faithful. When upon every high hill and under every green tree thou wanderest, playing the harlot, I will not transgress, they said. And yet they almost try to do it in every way possible. Verse 21, yet I had planted thee a noble vine, holy right seed. How then art thou turned into a degenerate plant, of a strange vine unto me? The idea of both these verses is the same. I gave you perfect opportunity to live and to flourish, and you squandered it. I gave you blessings, and you gave them away. The people couldn't turn to God and say it was faithful to us. We had just not been faithful to him. Letter B, trying to cover up obvious spiritual adultery. Trying to cover it up. So this is the way you're living. Verse 22, watch this. Though thou wash thee with nitre and take thee much soap, yet thine iniquity is marked before me, saith the Lord God. How canst thou say, I'm not polluted, I've not gone after Balaam? And so he says, spiritually, what you're trying to do do is you're trying to wash it so that nobody notices. We're the kid who just ate a piece of chocolate cake that we weren't supposed to. And we go to our parents and we say, no, I didn't. And we try to reason with kids like that. Look at your face. So we take them to the mirror and they're like, no, I ate no chocolate cake. And everyone in the room is saying, what a foolish child this is who thinks he can cover up his misdeeds. Or like pastor's illustration, trying to brush all of the jiggers off of his pants, and they're still everywhere else. And the same thing he says with us. Well, you're doing the wrong thing. You know what you are. You're not faithful to the Lord, and you know that it's true. He's given you your word, and you haven't read it. He's given you prayer. You haven't talked to him. We know we haven't been faithful. And so what do? We try to cover it up. I'm fine. I'm not polluted. So we wear the tie. We put on the coat. We walk with a spring in our step on our way into church. And we say, good morning, brother. How are you? What a bright and shiny day. And we cover ourselves up with soap, but God knows who we are. This is how you live. This is your normal Sunday. We talk like Christians, but we are ignoring our spiritual adultery. And God says, how can you say that? I'm not polluted. Go on to verse 23. He's about to get very mean. This is probably the most crass way he can say the way that they're living. Verse 23, how canst thou say, I'm not polluted, I've not gone after Balaam? See thy way in the valley. Know what thou hast done. Thou art a swift dromedary traversing her ways, a wild ass used to the wilderness that snuffeth up the wind at her pleasure and her occasion. Who can turn her away? All they that seek her will not weary themselves. In her month they shall find her. He gives one illustration about a camel dromedary wandering in the wilderness like we do, wandering in the world seeking for pleasure. But the second one is worse. He says, we're like a wild donkey wandering around in the time of her heat, looking for a mate to mate with. Now, when an animal is in heat, they give off a musk, and they draw all of the males who want to mate with her. So, watch. She doesn't have a hard time finding someone to mate with. He says, that's what you are. You not only do you allow sin in your life, you're open to the possibility of sin in your life. You're like a donkey wandering around looking for someone to come and give you pleasure. You're okay with the world that's around you. You're not just allowing it. You are looking for opportunities to fill your life with it. And he says, by the way, when you are like that, you give off a musk and sin finds you. Sin is not hard to find. The donkey who wanders around in the wilderness in the time of her heat looking for a mate doesn't have to wander long before she finds one. And the Christian who's wandering around in the wilderness looking for something to get involved in has had no hard time finding some. I've never heard of a single person saying, I tried to walk away from the Lord, but there was just no opportunities. You know. And so that's what it says. It says, they will not weary themselves. They shall find her. No, the world's not going to have a hard time getting into your house. It will find you, and you will find it. So this is what we are. We try to cover up our spiritual adultery. He says, that you try to wash yourself with soap, you know what you look like to me? That's what I see. Next, letter C. So what do? We claim it's unavoidable. It's unavoidable. It's just the way that it is. Look at verse 25. Withhold thy foot from being unshod, and thy throat from thirst. Now, there's a debate about what this means. Some people think it's a part of a rituals of worshiping other gods. Take off your feet. You abstain from certain drinks. Some people think it's a picture of the physical effort that we strain ourselves with. Like we wear out our shoes, or we are thirsty because of the effort we're putting into it. But at the end of the day, what he's telling us to do, either way, is he's saying withhold that. Stop it. He says, stop doing these things. Stop looking after these things. And what do they say? But thou saidest, look at verse 25, there is no hope. No, for I have loved strangers, and after them will I go. Wow. Stop. Stop being the donkey looking around for somebody to have pleasure with in the wilderness and in the world. He says, but I've loved strangers, and so after them I will go. That's just the way life is now. Look at verse 26. As a thief is ashamed when he's found, so is the house of Israel ashamed. It doesn't mean that they blushed at their sin, but it is embarrassing, right? It is a problem. We do lose a lot of good things in our life. As a nation is ashamed when they lose a battle, we will be ashamed when our life is falling apart. That's the idea of that. And he says, they, people, their kings, their princes, their priests, and their prophets, saying to a stock, thou art my father, and to a stone, thou hast brought me forth, for they have turned their back unto me and not their face. He says, so not only does he say, well, this is the way it is, but he also labels every area of society, the people, their kings, their princes, their priests, and their prophets. Everybody lives, well, it's just the way that it is now. I mean, it's just the way people live. And people, it's what people do, even good people I know. I heard a preacher on TV just the other day say exactly what I'm telling you right now. I said, I'm sure you'll find some of those. They're not hard to find. The world is filled with people trying to justify their sins. So if you want to find somebody to support you, you will have plenty of footnotes at the bottom of your research paper telling you why sin is acceptable. But that doesn't make it true. And he says, well, it's just the way it is. Look at the people. It's just, and then he almost makes fun of them. Yes, the world is filled with people looking at a stone saying, you have given me life. The world is filled with people looking at the world saying, I need you to fill me. And the world's also filled with empty people too, isn't it? Letter D, running to God only when you need something. Running to God only when you need something. So the picture he's painted for us almost makes it seem like these people would never turn to God. Oh, but not so. Not so. They'll show up at church when everything does fall apart. Look what happens. Verse 27. Saying to a stock, thou art my father. To a stone, thou hast brought me forth. Turn their back unto me and not their face. But in the time of their trouble, they will say, arise and save us. On a normal day, I will look to the world to fill me. Things are falling apart, that's when I show up in the preacher's office and say, what do I do? And so what does God say? God says the obvious thing. Well, if I don't fill you and the world does, well, why isn't the world here to fix your problem? Look what he says, verse 28. But where are thy gods that thou hast made them? Let them arise if they can save thee in the time of thy trouble. For according to the number of thy cities are thy gods, O Judah. You have a God in every city. You have plenty to go around. You should have plenty of help. Seems like. Verse 29. Wherefore will ye plead with me? You've transgressed against me, saith the Lord. Why are you running to me for help if you're not going to run to me for life? This is life. And so why is it suddenly true today and not yesterday? Now, he's asking a rhetorical question because the answer is obvious, but we live here. I'm not going to read it for you, but it reminded me of a passage in Judges. Judges is just this super sad story of going in a cycle. Things are bad, we turn to the Lord, God helps them, and so things are good, but then they turn away from the Lord, so things are bad. So they turn to the Lord, and God helps them, and then things are good. And since things are good, they don't need God, so they turn away from him. And they go in this circle, and they vacillate here for generations. But one time in the cycle, in Judges chapter 10, I gave it to you, we're not going to read it, but they go to the Lord and they say, hey, we need help, save us. And he said, go to the gods which you've chosen. Let them deliver you. I mean, the reason we're here is because you chose another god. Well, maybe they can help you. Try it out. Yeah. You know how God says to you, prove me. Yeah. Prove me. Why don't you try out following me and I will take care of you. He says the same thing. Them. Why don't you try them and see how well it goes? But we want to live how we want when things are good and then go to the Lord and help him to fix all of our problems all in a day when things are bad. Because we live in a place where we don't need God. Verse 30, look at this. In vain have I smitten your children. They received no correction. Your own sword hath devoured your prophets like a destroying lion. I try to do things in your life to get your attention and you completely missed it. Verse 31, O generation, see ye the word of the Lord? Have I been a wilderness unto Israel, a land of darkness? Wherefore say my people, watch, we are lords, we will come no more unto thee. Can a maid forget her ornament, bride her attire? Yet my people have forgotten me days without number. He says, have I not been there for you? Have I not been available? Have I been in darkness? It's not like I've not been around. When we started our relationship, I told you to build me a house, to put you in the center of the community, so you knew where I was. I am right here. I have not been darkness. I have not been a wilderness. But my people have lived their lives saying, we are lords, so we don't need you. That's how our everyday life is. Yeah. Our normal decisions Monday through Saturday is, I am the Lord. I am the captain of my ship and the captain of my soul. I am the one who will do as I please. And that's how we live. I am the Lord. I will come no more unto thee. And we have forgotten who we are. A Christian is that which is a person who has been given life from the Lord. That's who you are. But you can't be a Christian without the Lord. And he says, that's like a maid forgetting her ornaments or a bride her attire, but we have forgotten him days without number. It has become our life that we don't need him. If at all possible, we will be the savior of our own life. We will be responsible for our own prosperity. We do not need God to direct our steps or provide our needs or to make us happy. But we will return to him when it's absolutely necessary, and God will say, don't you have gods to take care of you? Letter E. I'll do quickly with this one. We indulge injustice for others and demand mercy for ourselves. Yeah. He says this, verse 33, why trimmest thou thy way to seek love? The idea is like you narrow your path to go after the love that you want. Therefore hast thou also taught the wicked ones their ways. You're becoming teachers of the wrong ways. Verse 34, also in thy skirts is found the blood of the souls of the poor innocents. I have not found it by secret search, but upon all these. Everybody wore a skirts. They wore garments. So he's not emphasizing a skirt or a dress. He's emphasizing your clothes. He says, I've seen blood on your clothes, and I didn't have to look for it. Your injustice fills your land, and there's blood on your hands, and it's obvious. That's what he's saying. So that's them. People who are innocent, injustice is rampant in their own hearts and their own minds. But when it turns to them, verse 35, yet thou sayest, because I am innocent, surely his anger shall turn from me. Behold, I will plead with thee because thou sayest, I have not sinned. We live this way. We spend our lives trying to tear down other people, but we always expect God to give mercy to us because we're us. Yeah. I'm innocent, and so he will take care of me. Surely his anger shall turn from me. And he will plead with us, saying, I can't believe that you would say, I have not sinned. I'm perfectly fine the way that I am. Everything I'm doing is perfectly acceptable. We got to move on. Letter F. We're getting to the end here. We live with confidence in hopeless places. So you don't need God. Not usually. But what are you going to do? Well, I got some things worked out. Verse 36. Why gaddest thou about so much to change thy way? So we're working really hard to make different plans. Look, that thou also shalt be ashamed of Egypt, as thou wast ashamed of Assyria. Yea, thou shalt go forth from him, and thine hands upon thine head. The Lord hath rejected thy confidences, and thou shalt not prosper in them. So what's so ironic is earlier in their history, they looked to these foreign nations for help. Some of those same foreign nations which were their own demise. And so they went after Assyria, please help us. And that didn't work out very well. They were ashamed in it. It turned out to their shame. But it's okay. It's okay. We got other resources. We'll go to Egypt then. At this time in their history, they have kind of a back and forth relationship with them. Sometimes they're their enemies. Sometimes they're looking to them for help. For example, one of them who's put on the throne later in just a few years is put there by Egypt because they were pro-Egypt. Hey, Egypt will be there for us. It's not going to be any better for you then, he says. You will be ashamed of them just as you were ashamed of Assyria. And he says, and they're going to take you with your hands on your head. They're going to take you away as slaves. This is not going to turn out well for you. I've rejected your confidences. All the things you have, and we this is how we live. Well, I don't need God because I got everything worked out. I got a plan for my future. I have a bank account set. I have insurance. I have insurance for my insurance. Everything's good. It's all set, And God says, I reject your confidences. They will not work for you. We think, okay, you know, serving the Lord is only for those who really don't know how to do life. But I know how to do life, so I can make it all work without him. This is how the Israelites were living. We'll make our alliances. We'll be like the other nations. It will work for us. The end of the story tells very much otherwise. And this is why we brought ourselves to this place. I'll give you the last one and we'll be done. This is chapter 3, the first couple verses before he ends his message. Number 4, God wants his people to know it is not a little thing. This is not a little thing. So, as I said, the chapter ends. The message doesn't end. The next message begins in verse 6. So look at verse number 1 of chapter 3, and then we'll be done. They say, he reminds them of something. This is still the adultery picture he's pulling. They say, if a man put away his wife, and she go from him, become another man's, shall he return to her again? Shall not that land be greatly polluted? But thou hast played the harlot with many lovers, yet return again to me, saith the Lord. He reminds them of a law. If a spouse is unfaithful and goes and marries another person, they can't renew that relationship and then everything be fine. This is the normal way of living. And at the end he says, yet return again to me. Here he says, and you return to me. The idea in the Hebrew is not as much that he's telling them to return, but showing them like they're acting like they can leave and come back and leave and come back and it doesn't make a difference. It does make a difference. He says, your own laws forbid that kind of action in everyday life. And you think, well, it's okay, God's merciful, so I can leave and come back and leave and come back. He says, that's not how a marriage relationship works, guys. We know that. You can't develop a relationship that way. There's a reason why that's not acceptable, because that just doesn't make society function. And that's not going to function with us either. That's not how this works. It can't work that way. It's not just a matter of God's mercy or not. It's just that's not how relationships develop. Verse 2, lift up thine eyes into the high places and see where thou hast been lain with. See where you have gone to and you have lain down with many lovers. The idea of that. In the ways hast thou sat for them as the Arabian in the wilderness. Thou hast polluted the land with thy whoredoms and with thy wickedness. Therefore the showers have been withholden and there hath been no latter rain. And thou hast been a whore's forehead that refuses to be ashamed. The idea of that phrase is that, like a prostitute is so used to her prostitution, she is brazen, she does not blush. And that's what it gives you its own commentary. She is not ashamed. He says, that's where you are right now. You're just so used to running away from the Lord that it doesn't even bother you anymore. You don't even notice. It's just the way life is. Verse 4, wilt thou not from this time cry to me, my father, thou art the guide of my youth. Will he reserve his anger forever? Will he keep it to the end? Behold, thou hast spoken and done evil things as thou couldest, or as much as you could. And that's where his message stops. He reminds them of a law that relationships are not built by vacillating back and forth with faithfulness one day, unfaithfulness in another day, or unfaithfulness most of the time, but only being faithful on the day when you need something. He says, does that work? Have you ever seen a marriage relationship flourish that way? Then why do you think suddenly we're going to be okay when that's the way that you live? It just doesn't happen. It's not a little thing. When we run to the world for pleasure and for life and for joy, and then we run to God when we can't pay our electric bill. He says, that's not the way this is going to work. And God's not going to just be like, well, it's okay forever. Or like as pastors talking to us, eventually we just start to live in the curse of this world. And whose fault is it? We have brought these things upon ourselves, he says. So that's his first message. Wow, we got through it.